Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Ren Wednesday. My co-host is Adam Wybray. Today we're joined by special guest Ava Foxfort, and we're talking about Who Framed Roger Rabbit from 1988 and Terrorvision from 1986. A full transcript of this episode will be available in the show notes. Enjoy!
I think that was the opposite of in time. Oh shit, you're going straight into an intro.
That's fine. Hi, Ava.
Hi.
Hi, Adam.
Hello.
Hi, Ren.
Hi, Ren.
You are Ren.
I am Ren. Okay, I think this is setting the scene perfectly for this episode.
No, I have made a lot of notes, okay? I have pages.
No, that's true. Adam has prepared. Maybe Ava has prepared.
Define prepared for me. I haven't made notes, but I've never made notes in my life.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, we're discussing two films.
Who Framed Roger Rabbit from 1988 and Terrorvision from 1986. And we decided to do this episode a long time ago and have now somewhat forgotten our reasoning. But
okay, so let me explain. So I found Terrorvision on a list of supposed children's horror films on Letterboxd. Uh-huh. Which is a lie, it's not.
It's so not.
But okay, so my thinking is that Who Framed Roger Rabbit, it's a Disney film, and it's PG rated, it's a family film that is largely not going to be understandable by a child audience. Like, I watched it as a child and it made me feel weird and troubled. And I probably didn't follow the plot, because the plot of Who Framed Roger Rabbit is quite complex. It's like a kind of Chinatown, like, film noir conspiracy with lots of kind of references to old cartoons that most kids watching in the late 80s wouldn't have got. On the other hand, Terrorvision is clearly a film made ostensibly for an adult audience that I don't think anyone over the age of 12 is going to enjoy.
So we've got definitely an adult film. One of them is definitely a horror film. One of them is horrific if you see it as a child. I imagine both of them would be horrific if you saw them as a child.
Well, that's the thing. I feel like both of these films have a really kind of specific squick that is going to really impact you if you see it as a kid. And, like,
so are we just going for, like, similarly traumatising? Is that the theme that we've got here?
Yeah.
You didn't see this as a kid. Was anyone traumatised by Terrorvision as a child?
I mean, I don't know how many people...
No, I mean out of us three. Like, we're allowed to...
No, no.
We're allowed to answer for ourselves, Adam.
No. I thought you were talking. Well, I assume none of you had. I mean, I thought you were talking for the audience.
Yeah, I assume anyone who saw that Terrorvision as a child was traumatised by it, but...
Well, I assume they're now locked up. But
I don't know, I feel like there was quite a charming... The thing that was confusing to me about Terrorvision was that there was quite a charming, childish humour to it. Woven in between all of the deeply inappropriate humour.
Well, that's what I mean. Well, it's a really juvenile film.
It's incredibly juvenile, yeah.
And ostensibly, the main two characters end up being the kind of the child character and the teenagers.
Yeah.
And it also, we've talked time and time again, like, hear me out on this. Like, time and time again on this podcast, we've talked about plots in which the child characters are not believed.
Yeah.
Right, in which there's some kind of monster or some kind of demonic or supernatural presence, and a child insists and insists that it's real, and all of the adults don't believe them, and the child's right, and bad things happen to the adults.
Yeah.
And that is exactly what the plot of this film is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it has a really, really classical children's narrative. Can we explicitly not make an argument for Terrorvision being child-friendly? Like, I think on a moral level...
To be fair, that on a moral level, that probably would rightfully get me barred from ever teaching again. I think... And that's definitely not the hill I want to die on or end my teaching career on, is Terrorvision as a children's film.
I need to introduce Ava. We have...
To who?
Has been on here before.
I know, she has, but it's been a while.
It has been a while.
Yeah, Ava Foxford, a veteran of the Deptford Mice series, which maybe you should go back and listen to, because it was quite an epic undertaking.
I think they're the best three episodes you've done.
Aww.
Yeah. Yeah.
They are, like, absolutely some of the best children's horror I've ever read. Like, and I remember reading it as when I was little and genuinely getting horror. So yeah, go and listen to me. Listen to more of me. I'm great. I'm Ava Foxford. I'm a guest today. I'm very confused as to why I'm here and what we're doing.
Thank you for coming back, Ava. I also don't know why we saw these two films and were like, Ava, let's get Ava for this. I don't know why.
Like, I'm offended by the suggestion that Terrorvision...
Yeah, I was going to say, that's probably not going to make you feel great about yourself. I mean, I don't know, maybe I saw that Medusa character.
I've got Medusa vibes. I think I aspire to Medusa vibes. I would really love that kind of rubberized snake... outfit thing that she's got. Like, I think it's a beautiful piece of costumery that I would 100% wear out.
Well, exactly. So maybe that's why. That's the only justifiable reason I could think of.
And, like, Who Framed Roger Rabbit was a beloved film when I was little. Like, this was absolutely my jam. So half of this makes sense. The other half... I don't know what you think of me.
just Medusa, really. But Who Framed Roger Rabbit, I watched as a kid, and I definitely watched it more than once, but I found it was one of those films I was fascinated by, but I found quite troubling. Yeah, I don't think I loved it as a kid. I think it worried me. What about you, Ren?
I saw it for the first time 2 days ago. So, yeah.
Oh, that's an interesting perspective. I'd like to hear, what your thoughts on it, which I guess is what we're here for, so that's good.
Yeah, all I knew coming in was that it combined animation and live action, and that there is a sexy lady called Jessica Rabbit. That was the sum total of my knowledge.
Yeah.
That's fair. That's probably the kind of legacy of the film, right? In terms of what someone who hasn't seen Who Framed Roger Rabbit would know about it, I would say, animation and live action and sexy Jessica Rabbit is probably what most people
know. I mean, like, it's probably the origin of my lifetime affection for Bob Hoskins.
Well, I was going to say, I was thinking this episode might be a meeting of the chapter of the Bob Hoskins Appreciation Society.
Oh, it absolutely is. Although my appreciation obviously comes from the Terry Gilliam film Brazil, in which he plays one of the Central Services heating engineers, and utters the classic line, which I'm sure I've already said on the podcast, because it just is one of the things that just comes. It's just absolutely embedded in my head, where he says, "Machines don't fix themselves."
Connection, because I did actually read Wikipedia this morning, so that's a level on which I'm prepared. Terry Gilliam was up to direct Who Framed Roger Rabbit for a while. He was one of the first directors to be picked, and he said it looked too difficult, so he didn't do it.
Yeah, it would absolutely never have got made if...
no way. Absolutely no way, and it would have been terrible if it had been.
And it would have taken 20 years to not get made.
We know that Robert Zemeckis's main interest in filmmaking is having increasing amounts of special effects hopefully replace the work of actors and cinematographers until I'm assuming his end point is he just wants to, you know, let AI do it. But at this point he was still having to do a lot of work, because this is way before the Polar Express. Right, it's way before here. This is non-digital filmmaking. So all of this film was achieved through optical printing. So what that means is basically it's all composite shots. So it was filmed with the live actors using kind of these awful, I encourage you to look this up, okay? These sort of horrible rubber stand-ins for the... And I would love, my jam would be to see just the film, the version of this, just cut together with the horrible rubber versions of the characters being waved around by puppeteers while the actors had to react to them. There's also, you know, like mechanical arms and other things. But basically, they filmed with the live actors, and then the animators had to use this kind of three-tier animation process. So the characters were drawn and coloured, and then the shadowing was added, and then the texturing. And the integration of, like, the lighting in this film. So the it's a film noir, basically. So we should say this is set 1947, Hollywood, and it's very much in the mold of something like Chinatown. You know, it's the LA of corruption and seedy bars and private eyes. And Bob Hoskins plays Eddie Valiant, who's a kind of down on his heel detective who's hired to find proof that Roger Rabbit's wife is cheating on him with Marvin Acme, which is a great invention of this film. So if you've ever seen Roadrunner and Coyote cartoons, you remember that everything that the Wile E. Coyote bought had Acme on the side and was produced by Acme. Well, it turns out that Marvin Acme is the factory owner who invents and produces all of these kind of gag objects.
There's a really, really lovely kind of sub-theme running through everything about that intersection between, like the concept that this isn't just that we're using animation on top of a kind of classic film noir. It's that we're living in a world where cartoons exist as pieces of entertainment, but they are acted. They are acted by real physical embodiments of people, right? And so having to have Acme and having to have all of the gag props available, all of the ridiculous, impossible ideas that cartoons make possible, have them be real mass-produced objects, it's a really particularly, like, or it's going to be the first time I'm saying it, textural kind of solidity.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, because these objects that are kind of squishy, like there's a lot of squash and stretch cartoon physics in this film, yeah. But obviously these are also the real chunky objects, and there's something really sort of satisfying about seeing things like the cartoon hammers, yeah, or those vinyl like holes that you throw on the wall.
I was thinking about the holes, yeah.
And that's all really satisfying. But yeah, so the process was they then did the lighting and then they did the textural effects, because the important thing was that the animated figures looked absolutely integrated into the real world. And I think that is pulled out off to an astonishing degree.
Yeah.
I mean, particularly, I think, matching the lighting on the animated characters to the lighting on the real-life actors, which is wild.
I mean, this is a famous term. You know, like, I can't remember where it originates here. I don't know how widely it's used, but that idea of, like, knocking the lamp, right? So there's a scene where they're in the back of the bar and Bob Hoskins walks into the room and immediately headbutts the light fitting that is dangling from the ceiling, which means that then for an entire, quite elaborately shot film, the light is just swinging around randomly.
Yeah, through the whole
scene. The whole scene, there's just this constant... And, like, this makes sense from a noir point of view, right? Like, noir is very much, like, built on that light and shadow. So there should be...
Yeah, you've got that expressionist.
Yeah. Mm. And so it makes sense for them to be doing things like this. But, like, my God, have they made it hard for themselves. And, yeah, knocking the lamp on the way in is, like, the perfect symbol of that thing. And I have heard that used as the term for when people go the extra mile to kind of sell a visual effect or anything in a way that's just like they've just made so many people's lives harder for themselves by making that decision.
Oh yeah.
And it doesn't technically add much to it apart from making it difficult. Right? I mean, it gives it more vibrancy and life and movement, so it makes sense. But, like, there's already, like, a cartoon rabbit constantly bouncing off the walls and Bob Hoskins playing, like, a perfect dead straight man to this. Like, there's already that kinetic energy to the scene, and to just add an extra layer of random difficulty, it's delightful. Like, I really treasure, like, all of the, like, little details of physicality throughout this film. And, like, I think I spotted them more watching it as an adult, looking through and just being like, God, that's such a difficult way to do that. That's so delightful. One of my favourite gags in the whole film that I don't think I ever spotted as a child was that, like, Jessica Rabbit obviously has quite I can't think of the right word, structurally impressive bosom.
I've seen the word pneumatic.
And at one point Bob Hoskins is picking up something off the floor and comes back up and knocks his head back into them and they make like a comedy drum noise, and it's like a perfect bit of slapstick that's been delivered with someone who isn't there. Right? Like, someone isn't in that room and Bob Hoskins has just had to pretend to knock his head on something, aware that what he's knocking his head on is someone's tits. Like, it's incredible. Well, like, it's so stupid. It's such a stupid film that takes itself so seriously, and I love that. I love that so much.
Yeah, it's really committed to the bit. Yeah. And I think it's that lack of cutting corners that really, really sells it. And I think, like, mentioning that moment, it's Bob Hoskins' mime work as well.
Mm.
Like, I think he came from a tumbling background. And, like, the amount of clowning he has to do in this film is astonishing.
Yeah. And that is set up within the world. Like, I don't think I realised when I was little that he does have a past life as a clown. like, it is narratively set up that Bob Hoskins' character, Eddie Valiant, was originally part of Eddie and Teddy Valiant, a pair of clowns, who were also cops for a while. And then private detectives, and then one of them died. And, oh God, there's a lot. There's an amount going on. It's quite an efficient. It's quite a dense film.
It is dense, especially, say, for now. Whether this is a children's film is not very clear. So this was produced in a period where Disney were going through a real slump. So we have previously talked about 1985's The Black Cauldron, which, as we talked about at the time, was a financial black hole for Disney. And Disney in this period making live-action films, you know, this was before the kind of so-called Disney Renaissance. And in fact, a lot of the animators who worked on Who Framed Roger Rabbit, did go on to work on The Lion King and those films of the Disney Renaissance, but we're not there yet. So this is a period where Disney, they're under new management, and they're trying to kind of find a way to broaden their appeal. And this was made in collaboration with Steven Spielberg. And the effects here are by Industrial Light and Magic. And, you know, I think you can see that it's trying to take that Spielberg family film formula that Spielberg had done so well with E.T. and films like The Goonies, and it's trying to get a very broad audience in. But in a way that I think is much preferable to what DreamWorks would then do with Shrek, because in Shrek, I think you've got these kind of two different registers of, oh, okay, it's the fairy tale stuff for the kids and the innuendo for the adults. Whereas here, it's much more integrated. There is a bit of, oh, okay, it's the cartoons for the kids and the film noir stuff for the adults, but you can't really extricate them at all. Like, it's all so mixed together.
I'm still trying to work out exactly what my understanding of patty cake was as a child, right?
Yeah.
Which here is used as a euphemism for sex, but also literal playing patty cake, doing hand games like Acme and Jessica Rabbit are found, like, photos on it. Oh my god, this is another beautiful scene as well, isn't it? Because Roger gets the photos of them playing patty cake on the bed and then flips through them and flips through them so as fast that they turn into an animation of that scene. And it's like, yeah. Oh my god. Like, you've just shown us how animation works through the lens of photographs taken and being interacted with by a cartoon character. It's beautiful. It's really beautiful filmmaking.
I heard you make a kind of ooh noise when I mentioned tumbling, Ren. Was that you thinking of Hoskins later in the film where he does his sort of song and dance routine?
No, I was just sort of enchanted by the idea of Bob Hoskins tumbling, I think. I think that's just delightful. I'm glad that I live in a world where that happened.
But he was generally like I think I saw it noted that most of his work before this was quite hard, serious acting. Like he was like 10th or 13th choice for this role in a way that feels quite harsh, because he does also seem completely perfect for this role. But they like tried to get Harrison Ford in, they tried to get Eddie Murphy in. He apparently really regrets not taking that role. Bill Murray was famously impossible to contact, so he missed out on the opportunity to go for this. But you end up with Bob
Hoskins.
Look at
this list. Robin Williams, Robert Redford, Jack Nicholson, Sylvester Stallone, Wallace Shawn.
Like, there's a lot of interesting versions of this film that could have been made. Right? Like, each of those suddenly turns it into an entirely different thing. But I'm glad we got Bob, because I suspect it improves the quality of the tumbling. I can't see Robert Redford doing a good tumble.
No. So the film starts actually with an animation, right? So they clearly want to set up who this Roger Rabbit is, because we're meant to kind of understand him immediately as, okay, he must be some kind of classic cartoon character, aka, you know, Goofy, Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck, etc. So it starts with this short cartoon with Roger Rabbit and Baby Herman. And actually, they produced 3 Roger Rabbit films after the release of Who Framed Roger Rabbit. And they all have that same structure of Roger Rabbit, some kind of pet rabbit slash babysitter who has to look after Baby Herman, who kind of blithely gets himself into lots of danger. And Roger is a kind of perpetual victim, basically. So he's a pretty pitiful character. You know, he tries hard, but he's very nervous. And everything goes wrong and he just gets kind of beaten over the head again and again. And what I find interesting about the animation, so the lead animator was Richard Williams, largely, I think, known, certainly online, because there have been loads of YouTube videos about it, for the much compromised, very, very long production running film, The Thief and the Cobbler, or Cobbler and the Thief, can never remember which way around it is. But he was a sort of legendary animator. And so he designed Roger Rabbit. And clearly, you know, Roger's sort of meant to have a lot of those iconographic elements of classic kind of Disney cartoon characters. But really, I think the three Roger Rabbit films seem closer to Tom and Jerry.
Mm-hmm.
And this film here is very much like a Tom and Jerry short. But perhaps stylistically, kind of closer to like a Tex Avery film.
I mean, it is one of the interesting things here, isn't it, that shows up in the kind of production notes, but also is visibly there, is that, like, this is a homage to quite a lot of different modes of animation at the same time, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's made by Disney, well, it was made by Disney in collaboration with Warner Brothers, right? Is that right?
Yeah, yeah, and apparently Spielberg himself had to do all the kind of business.
Yeah, yeah, but managed to get all of the different production houses, or a lot of the different production houses, to offer them. So this is one of the only times you will see certain characters together, because they would never do that. And then, like, this idea that getting Daffy and Donald together meant that they had to be portrayed as equally talented pianists.
Yeah, yeah. And you even get some of the old Fleischer characters crop up. You see Coco the Clown walk past on the street.
Oh, do you?
You? Yeah, and then you get quite a touching little bit with Betty Boop in the nightclub.
Yeah, the relationship between Eddie, Betty and Betty Boop and Eddie is quite charming, because it feels weirdly real. And then just the detail of she's like, oh, she's a bit down on her luck because nobody's into black and white cartoons these days. It's really sweet.
Yeah, he's got... I like the little figurine he has of Betty Boop on his desk.
Yeah. Oh, I haven't noticed that. That's lovely.
Yeah. But the animation we get at the start is, like, it's clearly structurally like a Tom and Jerry film, but it kind of looks much more like kind of the Animaniacs to me.
Yeah.
Almost. Mm. And there's a lot of kind of whiz-bang 3D effects, so... You've got, it must have been a pain to animate, because you've got the kind of, well, the camera, as it were, like swooping around this kitchen, right? Like diving up, diving down, lots of distortion, you know, extreme close-ups and so on. And I think the 3D effects are kind of immediately a bit unsettling, but it's also really important that they established that the cartoon world is also the real world,
yeah,
right? That this is a real 3D space. And so at the end of the short, we then immediately enter the film studio, and you see, yeah, the cameraman and Baby Sherman turns out to be played by, I don't know, like, he's a toon, so he's a baby, but he's got this gruff old man voice. So...
He's got. Does it not say at one point he's got the lust of a 50-year-old and the dink of a 3-year-old?
The dinky, yes, the dinky of a 3-year-old,
which is, yeah, it's unsettling.
So, and apparently Richard Williams loved Baby Sherman and insisted on doing all of Baby Sherman's.
Herman Sherman's in Terrorvision.
Herman, sorry, and yeah, did all of Herman's animation himself. But yeah, I mean, was he born? Presumably, these toons, they're kind of ageless, right? I mean, they're talked about as being immortal, and previously nothing's been able to kill them. So presumably, he's always existed as this kind of old man baby, yeah, right?
I mean, maybe at one point he was a baby, and, like, his internal, yeah, self has simply aged normally. Oh, God, Dev, what a hideous, okay, life.
I don't know, he seems to quite like being pushed around in the pram and stuff.
Yeah.
So.
It's hard to have a lot of sympathy for the lecherous baby, I'll be honest with you.
He is, it should be noted, a very lecherous baby, which is quite disturbing.
Watching this for the first time, you know, the other day, like, I didn't know that, you know, it sort of starts with this animation and kind of I didn't know what was going to happen next. And then when it sort of, they call cut and it sort of zooms.
Because that could have been like that could have been a pre-feature thing, right? Like, it would have actually been possible for it to be like, oh, right, sometimes films just have a little cartoon in front of them, or films of that era. So it could have been that, right? Like, you can read that as a fake out.
So it did feel quite surprising and magical. I was like, oh my god.
It really sells this cartoon world, and that you really believe. I mean, I guess, and this has been written about before, but it feels like the cartoons are kind of segregated, right? That you have some kind of, I don't know, apartheid maybe, like, or at least sort of, or Jim Crow like. It never really commits itself to being a commentary on racism or anything like that, but it seems like the Toons are treated as second-class citizens, at least.
Yeah.
I mean, but whilst also being, like, functionally immortal and allowed to just do whatever they want, apart from the villain judge who... I don't think it's delving there, but there is definitely interesting parallels to make, because I think that there is a... I mean, it's just so strange. It's so strange, everything that they do. Like, how exploited are these workers? Like, what does it matter if the creature is immortal? Like, I think it was something that I was reading afterwards, but like, implied a sort of melancholy to Roger's character, because he's so focused on, like, well, people will only like me if I make them laugh, right? Like, he's got a... There's some weird stuff going on. I'm just going to leave it at that.
Oh, yeah, he sees it as his existential function, right? He later says, you know, I'm a toad, I've got to make people laugh. And there are moments of, like, suspense in the film where it's really imperative that Roger doesn't laugh because it draws attention to him. But he can't help himself. Yeah. It's like every fibre in his being, because he's a toon, is urging him to make jokes.
Yeah.
But also, like, yeah, this is clearly a commentary on the kind of 1940s studio system. So we've mentioned, we see Dumbo, and actually I've not appreciated how complex this shot is, but we see Dumbo flying outside the window of...
Maroon.
Yeah, Maroon's office. Thank you. Thanks, Ava. And you see Dumbo through the blinds. And that sounds simple enough, but they are animating Dumbo. So they're having to animate Dumbo, right, while leaving bits of Dumbo out and make it look completely...
And having him interact with the blinds, right? Like, that was one of the things that struck me there, is that, like, the blinds are moving in response to Dumbo's trunk whilst not being hooked up to anything. Like, it's such odd bits of puppetry, because the puppetry is aimed at physical objects throughout the film.
And apparently poor sweet Dumbo has been got on loan from Disney. Yeah.
Along with loads of the cast of Fantasia, who then show up in the next scene just as background characters and people that Eddie bumps into.
The broom, you can see the broomsticks and the little demons on the end of Fantasia. Yeah. Yeah, it's all those little Easter eggs that I think make it really, really charming. So Eddie's hard to investigate. And as we say, he finds that Jessica is playing patter cake with Marvin Acme. And then Acme is found murdered. And I guess all fingers, point to Roger as the kind of spurned husband.
And So Valiant is kind of brought into, well, because he's already, he did this job of sort of taking the photos of Acme with Jessica Rabbit. It was very conflicted about it because he said he didn't want anything to do with toons after his brother had been murdered by a toon. But he's sort of unwittingly drawn into this. And he finds Roger Rabbit in his bed. he has a Murphy bed.
That he pulls down for a nap in broad daylight, middle of the day, is just like, right, now's time for a lie down.
Yeah, because they look like just a bunch of filing cabinets where he'd keep his case notes, don't they?
Yeah.
And Roger obviously says, you know, I'm not guilty, you know, I didn't, I'm not a murderer. And handcuffs himself to, to poor Eddie. So Eddie's kind of bound to Roger, even if he doesn't want to be involved. And soon they're being investigated by the antagonist of this film, Judge Doom.
Yeah, and this is where the children's horror comes in, with
Christopher Lloyd.
Yeah, Christopher Lloyd being the demon headmaster, right? Like he's got
very similar aesthetic. Yeah.
So obviously he'd previously been in Zemeckis's Back to the Future, but here, yeah, he's a much less benign character. He has these sort of nasty, he's very white, very fake, false teeth.
I mean, it's a brilliant bit of casting, just in terms of like Christopher Lloyd very much looks like a cartoon character and very much is able to perform as a cartoon character, and then to put him into this serious, even ignoring the twist.
We don't know at this stage.
But ignoring that, like, still to have him be that kind of cartoonish whilst being this kind of villain, this kind of nasty, uncaring, unfeeling, monstrous character who putting of the shoe, the animated squeaky shoe in the dip has got to be like the most horrific kicking the dog of any TV show of any show ever. Like, right, if you've got that trope of, we need to establish just how evil this guy is, oh yeah, he's just gonna torture a shoe for being in the way. Which I guess wouldn't normally be a problem. Normally shoes are fine,
it's a living sort of anthropomorphic,
and it's adorable, and it's just got
voiced by Nancy Cartwright.
Oh my god.
Little Bart Simpson shoe with a little squeaky kind of voice. Was not a voice, just squeaks. Adorable big eyes. And Judge Doom wants to kind of show off this dip he's developed, because before now there's been no way to kill toons, and he's developed this dip which I can't remember what it's made of.
I think it's turpentine and acetone are the two main ingredients, which are like legitimate. Yeah. Like this is how you clean a cartoon cell, right? Like this is how you wipe.
Ah, okay. So it's
completely factually accurate. If you wanted to kill a cartoon, that is what you would need.
And he has these little uncanny elements to his performance that make him scarier. Like, I don't know if you noticed, like Ren, but he doesn't blink once in the film.
No, I didn't notice. That's
because he's got these, we later see his wild cartoon eyes, but they're going to set that up. Yeah, he never blinks in the film. And he's also, they often used a fan when he is... on screen, just to make his kind of cape move slightly. So he's just got, yeah, so he's just got these tiny little elements that make him uncanny, yeah. Basically, even before we know he's a cartoon.
I kind of like knowing the ending. I kind of liked how many clues there were throughout. Like, I think paying alert attention to certain details will give away the kind of twist and mystery elements of the things. But like it's just that thing of it being a very, very tight script in a lot of ways. Like, it just, everything that is said has actually got some hidden meaning or is pointing back towards something. So you really do get that, like, noir conspiracy vibe running through it.
No. And that screenplay was revised a lot of times over several years. And I think actually for the better here, because it doesn't feel focus grouped. You know, it's still very weird. but it is just, it doesn't have any fat at all. It's a very, like, lean kind of film. For instance, there used to be more weasels, for instance. They had to cut those down. So there were 7 weasels. So the weasels are like Judge Doom's henchmen, basically, like this nasty little police force. And they kind of help with the interrogations. And it was meant to be based on the 7 dwarfs originally. So the Richard Williams designed his own weasel versions of the dwarfs. And it was like greasy, sleazy, wheezy, slimy, etc. But had to cut them down to 5.
There's kind of so much you could say about this film. I think it is a masterpiece. It's just like so much care and effort has gone into this film, which is just kind of, I don't know, I think just good to experience as a human. It's just like, oh, someone's put so much love into this film. And it's such a weird result, but like,
it's that thing of, like, you feel that love for the effort that's gone into it, but also it itself is a love letter to these kind of bygone, like, you know, film noir wasn't hugely fashionable at that point, right? And it's just clearly very, very in love with, like, the whole history of animation building up to it, and really wanted to celebrate that, whilst also talking about the Hollywood system and kind of corruption in there. Like, one of the things that delighted me reading the Wikipedia, I mean, delighted / horrified, is that, like, so one of the big themes of this is actually the trams, right? The red car trams running through Hollywood. Eddie uses one of them to hitch a ride right at the very beginning, and then borrows some cigarettes from some children, which is a lovely little character detail that you get there. Like, he helps a little kid get onto the front of the trolley car. But this has just been brought up by Cloverleaf, who, it turns out, are part of this giant conspiracy, and attempting to build a freeway through LA, and this is legit, right? Like, this is one of those little details that, like, to me, it just felt like, oh, it's just like, it's just really knows my particular, like, anti-car bias and my desire for public transportation. Like, it references how great LA's public transport is at the beginning and says it's the best in the world, and then this is because part of the narrative is that, well, yeah, a syndicate of motor companies bought the real LA red car, so that they could throw it out of business, so that they could build that freeway that runs along the route that the trams previously did. Like, it's legit. Like, it knows the history and it cares about the history in a way that, I love that. I love that sort of thing. I love the layers of detail that run into this essentially very silly, what if cartoon characters were real? And it kind of wants to delve a little bit into what that means. Like, the idea of, like, there's something about the idea that, like, oh yeah, well, obviously Daffy and Donald would be like having to supplement their income, like playing bars in between shows, like, and of course they'd have like a really petty rivalry. I don't know. It's so strange on so many levels, and I really appreciate it for it.
Well, you're sort of suggesting that it's a very deep and textured film, so. Should we do texture of the week?
Yeah,
I had actually forgotten until we sat down that I had to come up with the best texture. So yeah, well, but yeah, let's do it. Okay. I'm sure I can come up with something.
Maybe I should change our voices so we're high pitched like cartoons or something.
Oh yeah.
Okay, so Ren, do you want to start?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not. Obviously, there's a lot of choice, and I went with quite an obvious one, but it's just the monster from Terrorvision. It was just so much texture. I couldn't snub it for texture of the week.
Okay, so we'll move on to Terrorvision, but you're so Terrorvision. Yeah, one of the main, I guess, antagonist of the film, although it's just hungry, really. Is this monster, and I think it doesn't redeem the film, but the latex monster, you know, it's definitely worth seeing a picture of, because as you say, it is disgusting.
It's so wet.
I mean, like, I would specifically nominate the first time you see the granddad's face pull out of the mouth of the beast.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that is a texture. That is a textural to itself.
Yeah, the amount of, like, KY jelly they must have, like, slathered on his face is ridiculous.
Oh, God.
So mine is we mentioned the shoe tune being dipped. And so for me, it's the shoe tune blood sludge on the black glove. So Judge Doom wears this one black glove like a true kind of fascist when he does his dipping. And after he's dipped the shit, he's got this awful kind of, yeah.
I mean, it's so lovely as well, isn't it? Like, that's coded as, very much coded as blood, but presumably it's just the ink, right? It's the paint that's gone into this character just being now dissolved and oozing down his hand. But, oh, yeah, it's good texture.
Yeah.
Did you manage to come up with one?
Well, so, I mean, basically, I'm just going to shoehorn in my own childhood trauma, as usual. So I think, weirdly, like, my texture is just the texture of cartoon. Like, that clean, like, block, cells, shaded, however you want to frame it. Like, the texture of cartoons to me is so disconcerting, and so the constant pulse between the texture of like a gritty film noir and an actual cartoon, like at that fundamental level. When I was young, I think I've told Ren this before, I might have even mentioned it on this podcast before, when I was young, one of my recurring nightmares was simply pastel blocks of colour, just huge abstract pastel blocks of colour suddenly turning to these jagged, raw, like the same shapes, but with all of the joins between them now being this like monstrously, like a different way of drawing these colours, a different texture to those colours. So this is kind of why I'm always fascinated by the texture of the week thing, to be perfectly honest, which is why I think it might have come up before. But like, nothing represents that than like the disconcertingness of like constantly flipping between these different textures that is through this film. And I remember being really unsettled with this film when I was little. I remember really loving it on one level, being fascinated by it and excited by cartoons getting to be chaotic in the real world. Like, it's genuinely magic. But then even before you get to the fact that these cartoons are being dipped in dip and destroyed in, like, really viscerally disgusting ways that are really played as horrific, they're really played as painful and torturous. Even before you get that, just that mix of textures, like, puts me in, like, a slightly uncanny place that means that the whole film has this texture of, like, fear to it. Doesn't come through in the same way as an adult. At this point, like, I kind of can distance myself from that by discussing the technique and the themes. But as a child, like, I think I was genuinely really upset by it. And genuinely, like, had that slightly... I don't know. I had this with a lot of things that I watched when I was little, where I didn't quite understand everything that was going on, where there was this kind of transgression between what I understood and what I didn't. And then this was just one of those films that I had recorded off the telly. And that in itself is another real like, odd texture of, like, VHS tapes that you've watched 100 times and don't quite understand.
Does it have, like... Did it have adverts in it, like...
I don't think this one did. It will have had something in the beginning and end, but I think I got a BBC screening of it at some point, so it was fine for adverts. But yeah, just the way it is layered is fundamentally quite disconcerting, because it is a bit too real. And like how much would you freak out if a cartoon walked into the room right now? Like, just think for a moment, right? Roger Rabbit walks in through the door. It's not a good feeling. Like, everything that you understand or what about the world has just been dismantled right in front of you.
Like, and obviously this layering gets flipped. Just over halfway through the film, in which Eddie has to go to Toontown. So, up to this point, we've had cartoons integrated into the real world, and then Eddie has to venture across into Toontown.
Like, going through the tunnel in between the two, with, like, genuine amazing... dread on his face, right? Like, it's the existential horror of having to go back to Toontown when he hasn't been there since his brother died.
Is this painted black tunnel, and they painted the whole tunnel black. And then he's driving through, and then there's this astonishing shot where these red curtains come up at the end of the tunnel, and suddenly you're in Toontown. And it's visually, like, really, really zany, really wild. Like, it looks like one of those... It looks like about three old Merry Melody cartoons, like those old Disney cartoons, come to life at once. And you've got loads of these characters, like, skipping around and cavorting, little birds circling round Eddie's head. You know, the plants weaving and dancing and singing, like, all these animals singing. And it's just incredibly overwhelming. Like, I think that moment, to me, it's a bit like in The Wizard of Oz when you shift.
But they've already established this ominousness about it, right? Like, Eddie's relationship with Toontown is complicated enough that, like, when they first visit the factory, like, and he's like, oh, I haven't been this close to Toontown in ages, and then they've got a shot over the wall. And so you've got this wall, and behind it you have this cavalcade of colour and drama. And so you have that initial, like, hint of it, and then this opening up into it, the full red curtain effect, and it's all singing at you, literally singing. And Eddie is horrified. Yeah. Like, oh, it's lovely.
and it kind of visually obviously changes as well, because this is where we kind of switch into blue screening, and it looks a little bit like a kind of 90s FMV game. Like, it did make me think a little bit of, like, FMV adventure games I've played. But yeah, it's still great. A different... they had a different animation team do Toontown. So a lot of this film was actually, interestingly, filmed in Britain. So a lot of it was filmed in London, and apparently it was very cold. So they're having to, you know, bring in all these palm trees and things and make it look like out LA, very hot LA. And apparently, yeah, it was bitterly cold a lot of the time. And then they had Industrial Light and Magic doing their stuff, and then also an animation unit in California as well. And
I thought the animation unit was based in the UK as well.
The animation unit just for Toontown.
I see.
So they had a separate animation unit just for Toontown.
Brilliant.
Amazing. Another sort of weird layer of, like, with Toontown is that, like, at Disneyland, or at least one of the Disneyland, probably several of the Disneylands, there is a Toontown.
Oh, like, my gosh.
They've made a real little town that's in the style of an animated town. It's just this sort of recursive layers of... Yeah.
Everything has so many layers here, right? It is that fascinating thing of, like, this film has been made by projecting layers on top of each other, and it's got lots of layers. It's very clever. I like it.
but it turns out that the murder was committed by Judge Doom and his goons. And that it's all part of this conspiracy to sort of take control of Toontown so he can then demolish it, basically.
Yeah, demolish it and build a freeway. I do really enjoy the scene of Christopher Lloyd explaining how delighted he is by the concept of a freeway. Like, just the idea of, like, it'll be huge, and then there'll be loads of cheap motels, and it'll just be, and he describes this paradise in this, like, absolutely hellish way, but has this genuine fervour for it that I like it.
And Eddie, of course, says that only a toon could come up with an idea that crazy.
Which, again, bear in mind, it's real. Like, this is a real piece of infrastructure history. I mean, sorry, to be clear, Toontown is not real. But the idea of building a freeway to replace the public infrastructure that was already there is very much a real historical moment. So I appreciate Eddie. I like Eddie a lot. Eddie and Teddy Valiant. I love that they're Eddie and Teddy.
And it turns out that it was Judge Doom who also killed his brother. And he reveals his high cackling voice and his red staring eyes.
One of my favourite odd little clever script-based clues here is that there's two times in which the word simoleons is used to mean money in this film, right? And the first one is describing how Judge Doom bribed his way into office, and the second one is describing what the toon who killed Eddie's brother stole from the heist where that murder happened. Right, so I don't know how I spotted this, but it's so lovely to me as a detail that they just used that same, like, classic noir slang. Just to make that connection and make it possible to kind of, like, solve the mystery yourself. Oh, I love it. I love it. I love it. Sorry, I'm a bit too excited about this film.
Well,
no, it's great.
Something that they did have to take out, though, because obviously, you know, Disney had to sign off on all of this, as did the other, you know, other film executives from Warner Brothers and the other studios. And apparently, in one iteration of the script, and the screenwriters, so there's an audio commentary on the 24th 25th, I think, anniversary Blu-ray release, which well worth getting. Loads of extras. It's got a commentary with Zemeckis, Frank Marshall, Jeffrey Price, Peter Seaman, Steve Starkey, and Ken Rolson. And yeah, the two writers say that they wanted it to be Judge Doom who killed Bambi's mother. But yeah, apparently Disney wouldn't let them do that.
Oh, that's brilliant.
It does. It seems so unlikely that this film was made. Yeah. Like.
Oh, well, and it must come from that fact that Disney was in such a slump at that time. Yeah, yeah. Right? And like, it is interesting the idea that, like, in some ways, this was part of the kickoff of the Disney Renaissance, right? Like, this was a real success at the time.
Yeah,
like, and despite being. Probably being, I think, the most expensive animated feature of the up to date as it was created, and that was before it went over budget. But it was a huge success, and it was popular, and it did genuinely make people excited about cartoons, and it made some of the stuff that Disney then started producing now thought of as the Disney Renaissance. It was a kickstart to some of that, and
yeah.
That's weird and amazing, right? Because this is a very, like, every step of the way, decisions have been made to make something very bizarre, to commit to that thing, to make it, to make it as real and specific as it is. Like, I talk a lot about the fact that, like, for me, great art isn't necessarily about being, like, functionally good, which, to be clear, this film is, but it's about people making strong decisions and, like, fully committing to them. And, like, this is 100% a film that has decided to make that powerful decision of, like, no, we are going to treat this like it is a real world where humans and cartoons coexist, and we're going to attempt to base everything on that completely. We're going to go full film noir. We are not going to, like, we're not going to stay back from that. We're not going to be coy about that in any way. We are going to make it be a film noir full of comedy slapstick, because those are the elements that we're bringing together. And it does it, and it did it, and it was a great success as a result. Unlike the film that I'm normally talking about, unlike the Bob Hoskins film that I'm normally talking about when I say I like a film that makes a strong decision and commits to it, which is, of course, Super Mario Brothers 1993. I like that Ren absolutely knew that was coming.
Yeah, well, we could always have you back on the podcast to discuss that.
Oh my God. I think that would make sense. That would make more sense than me trying to discuss Terrorvision, which we're going to have to start doing in a minute, right?
Yeah, we are. So, Judge Doom.
Segway.
Has poor Roger and Jessica tied up, ready to receive the dip, but is revealed as a cartoon himself and ends up being dipped himself. So, in a moment that recalls the I'm melting scene from The Wizard of Oz, the dip is released, floods this factory, and I will say this was a real factory. So this is one of the few. Few locations that isn't a studio set, actually. I really love the factory as a location. It's got some really bizarre background details, like there's a giant pink elephant, presumably one of the pink elephants on parade, I guess.
Right.
From Dumbo. Like,
I thought it was interesting how much of this physical space you're introduced to. Like, we kind of start off with an earlier spot, and they do a load of Chekhov's cartoon mallets.
You see
the props, and you kind of, they're just a throwaway thing, but they're almost all used in that final confrontation, which is, like, beautifully located within that space, and really feels into the nature of it, and it's horrifying. Like, Judge Doom dies horrifically twice. Like, horrifically.
Steamrolled first.
The steamroller, like, flattened. Actually seeing someone steamrolled because they've got glued with their foot and hands to it. It's an appalling death. And then even more disconcerting, you see him have to reinflate himself. Like, you see him kind of, like, peel up.
Oh, yeah, there's a lovely bit of stop motion, actually. Yeah, where they have him sort of 2D, sort of, yeah, wibbling about, and then he has to inflate himself with helium, like a balloon.
Which finally forces his eyes to pop out, yeah.
Yeah. and then, yeah, he's melted. Yeah, I almost chose the texture of Judge Doom's corpse, actually, as my texture.
Yeah.
Because he really becomes complete mush. Like, kind of liquidizes, and then at the end, there's this awful kind of plastic latex mask of his face.
Yeah.
just with all the kind of goop around it.
Which was a little bit, Rider BFM, the substance.
Yeah, weirdly, actually, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of, it is the kind of goop that we get, actually, in Terrorvision. So that's one thing that unites these two films. They're both very goopy.
Yeah, from a beloved classic of with an astonishing amount of effort and care put into it, to Terrorvision, 1986.
Which is probably the grodiest film I've ever seen. I was trying to settle on the word. I think Grody.
Grody's absolutely the word. Like, I think you could define Grody using this film.
Yeah.
Which as we sort of trailed at the beginning, does have a solid children's horror core to it, but is then unrelentingly and dementedly horny.
it was so, like, not knowing anything going into this film, right? Like, I was kind of expecting, I don't know what I was expecting, but I was expecting children's horror, I think, is going to say. I don't know if you know this podcast, but I believe it's supposed to be about children's horror.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, like, there was, which kind of could have held up for quite a lot of the intro. Like, you see we're in space and the beast is being disposed of, but is being turned into electricity and then beamed and bounced around the universe towards Earth. That all adds up.
Yeah.
And then we've got this setup of some kids staying home. And,
yeah, exactly. You've got two child protagonists. You've got, you know, adults not believing them. You've got goofy humour. It's all really colourful. It looks like Pee Wee's Playhouse, as someone's pointed out online. I thought, yeah, it's true.
But then it's...
how is this not children's horror either? Like,
well, the thing is that you step into it. I stepped into it expecting children's horror.
Yeah, yeah.
And just found the innuendos, like, because quite a lot of, like, kids film or family films quite often, like, have those little bit of innuendo for the parents.
Exactly.
And so, like, it kind of fades in a way where it's like, initially it's like, okay, this is a little bit of its era, a bit dated. I wouldn't really have made that reference now. I wouldn't want to talk about grabbing heinies so quickly, but okay, I can see how they're doing that double layer thing.
Excuse me, but Ava, I will quote from Who Framed Roger Rabbit, 50-year-old's lust, the 3-year-old's dinky, okay?
Yeah, that's like, one moment of, like, feeling, like, a bit deeply problematic in the middle of this film, whereas this is just constantly that. Like, this is, like, as early on, when I was still not quite sure what I was watching, and hadn't... I mean, I still don't know what I was watching, if I'm perfectly honest. I could see that there was but the innuendos increased. And, like, at one point I was relieved because they talked about going out to swing and then made a joke about it being, they were going to some dance lessons. And it was only later on revealed to be like, no, we're going to see some swingers. this is going to be a major part of the movie. Like, a good, like, 15, 20 minute chunk is going to be the mum and dad of this family, like, hitting on another couple in their pleasure dome. Oh my God, what is this film? One thing I would say is Ren, in your intro, I think you referred to it as not like, or you implied that Roger Rabbit was something where a lot of effort had been put into it, and this yeah. I think you were implying there was no effort put into this, and I don't think it's zero effort. Like, I think there's been an incredible amount of set design work, in particular, yeah, like yes. the physical, the props, the scenery, and all of those elements are clearly like labours of love. In a way that is almost certainly the only redeeming feature of this film.
I want a survivalist bunker like that granddad's, to be honest. if we're going to have to, you know, see out a complete, you know, civilizational collapse, I want his bunker's great. It's got all the stuff in it. It's a brilliant bunker. And I want the grandpa's costume, which is a military jacket with plastic soldier toys glued to it.
But yeah,
you're going to fit in really, really well down at the survivalist community, aren't you? Like, just rocking up at the libertarian rally in your waistcoat coated in little army men.
Yeah.
I did have the note, like, what is this house? Because
it's a palace.
It is some kind of mansion. Some kind of erotic desert mansion.
It's an erotic desert mansion.
It's just a classic suburban house, Ren. I don't know what you're talking about.
well, the couple who arrive, the man says, "Oh, it's very Greek," and you know, the husband says, "No, it's Roman." So it's clearly got this kind of Roman influence to it. There's a lot of sculptures. There's some very tasteful art on the walls.
Own lots of it in every room.
The filthy art isn't limited to the Pleasure Dome in any way. No, right, in a way that it is disconcerting.
If it's like the art is kind of like if Andy Warhol designed like erotic clip art.
Is there not one thing that's just like four breasts on a surfboard? Like...
Yeah, it is like, well, one thing I kind of find fascinating about this film is, as you say, like, it's got this relentless horniness, and yet it's one of, I mean, I might, like, maybe if you were a kid, like, you know, you started puberty and you watched this, like, maybe you'd find some of it appealing, but I think it's probably, like, the least sexy film about sex time I've ever seen.
Yeah, no, nothing is sexy here.
Yeah. It's astonishing.
Nothing.
Like... Yeah.
Well, and also, like, yes. It is like, okay, maybe why I felt this had children's horror feeling is it almost is like a child's idea of sex, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
The way the characters talk about sex, like, the husband, like, you know, yeah, the one... seeing someone's breasts and going, "Holy tomatoes! Or, that bikini is dynamite!"
Yeah, no, it is... I think that's a good way of describing it. It's kind of... Yeah, it is kind of like an 11-year-old's view of sex.
And I think weirdly it does kind of commit to that in quite a few ways throughout the process. Not least the kind of like the revelatory horror of the fact that all of the parents have been taken over by aliens is essentially just mum, dad, their two swinging friends and grandpa all in bed together, covered in horrible alien goop. And having the kids walk in on this, in a way...
Yeah, like, and
play it quite blasé, but also the kids are clearly horrified.
Well, and Sherman, the youngest kid, the boy, he says, "I thought it was a monster." And the older teenage girl says, "That's okay, Sherman. Someday you'll understand."
I don't think Sherman should have to understand that.
No.
Yeah, I mean, I think Child Protection Services should probably be getting on that.
Yeah, there's definitely a failure. There's an institutional failure to recognise what is going on in this house.
Yeah.
On several levels.
Sherman, Sherman seems happy enough. Like he loves his granddad, and he loves playing around with guns. In terms of child actor with massive prop guns, I think this film wins out because Sherman has to spend a lot of time with really proper, like, military grade guns.
Do you really see the BoJack Horseman episode where, like, Todd is like, because Todd is asexual and he has a girlfriend who's also asexual, and they have to go and meet her family, and it's like this kind of comedy reversal where, like, the family are all, like, enormously sexual in at every possible instance, and they're, like, having to Todd. Yeah, they're trying to tell. She's trying to tell her parents that she's asexual. No. Yeah, I felt like this family is like the family.
Yeah, Sherman could have easily grown up into Todd, right? Like, I mean, maybe not the libertarian gun nut elements.
Yeah.
Susie's hair and costuming is utterly fabulous. If we're looking for some positive things for me to say about this film, like, oh my god.
Yeah.
Susie looks incredible in this film. Like, it's like the perfect embodiment of 80s teen neon bouffant hair in multiple layers.
Mm-hmm.
Those little Madonna gloves. Everything perfect about the costuming there. She also went on to play Princess Joanna in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Ooh, nice.
Which is a significantly better 80s film, I'm going to say. I'm willing to say that. I'm willing to put my flag in the ground there. Were we trying to describe the plot? The satellite is broken.
I don't know. Yeah.
A monster's come to Earth. The parents are swinging. Grandpa's exposing his child to, like, faintly pornographic Medusa horror night.
Well, so Medusa is basically like a kind of parody of Elvira, as far as I could tell. So, you know, buxom presenter in revealing costume who makes lots of innuendo and presents horror films, or very low rent horror films, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, if Who Framed Roger Rabbit is a love letter to film noir and classic animations, you could say this film is a love letter to kind of bad 50s horror and sci-fi, basically.
I think it's a love letter to, like, I think one of the things that is, that does explain, like, the weird kind of nostalgic perviness of this is, I think it's a love letter to growing up in the 80s, right? In the sense of, like, being a child exposed to media that you shouldn't, and, like, being excited to stay up late and watch horror. Like, you know, this is clearly made by people who love horror films. Like, I think it's a real experience of, like, kids seeing this sooner. And, like, I don't think it's, like, a sensitive satire, but I think that there's a satirical nature to how it's just saying, like, this is what kind of 80s capitalism creates.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't want to defend this film much. I did quite enjoy it. Like, I cackled a lot.
Yeah.
There were definite moments of cackling throughout. It makes strong choices and commits to them, so I think it's high quality art. So
I did like the monster. I like the monster.
The monster's very good. The monster's like a giant boglin with an extra eye and bonus mouths that just appear whenever they need to.
So the story is that the monster is called a hungry beast, and it's a kind of house pet that people have on this planet, but they are prone to mutation, and when they mutate, they have to be exterminated, which is done by transforming them into pure energy and beaming them to the furthest reaches of the galaxy.
And unfortunately, in this furthest reaches of the galaxy was... which was just a bureaucratic error that, like, there's a very, very worried waste disposal alien.
Yeah. The sanitation captain keeps appearing on the TV to implore the people of Earth to turn off their devices.
For the next 200 years. Like, please turn off your televisions for the next 200 years.
Which I do think is I think this is a good children's horror plot.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. To come back to that. Is it sponsored by Heineken?
It must have been sponsored by Heineken. Yeah. There was Heineken money in
there. There's a lot of Heineken in it. Yeah.
There's a lot of Heineken.
Yeah. Also odd, but yeah.
I mean, weirdly, the thing that reminded me of was Blue Velvet, which has a scene in it where Karl McLaughlin really enjoys some Heineken and then goes for a wee, and while satisfiedly weeing in the urinal, just shouts, Heineken. they weren't the only people getting Heineken money. Television wasn't the only people getting Heineken money at this era, which makes me feel like they must have been being quite profligate with some people in the Heineken marketing department who did not have a concept of quality control or like caring for the reputation of like their brand.
Well, interestingly, with Who Framed Roger Rabbit, it said on the commentary that they wouldn't disclose, sadly. I'm assuming it was Heineken now, that there was a drinks company that really wanted it to be their drink that Roger drinks when Roger drinks alcohol in the film. Mm. It's like his head kind of goes red and it becomes like a kind of an alarm, like a smoke, like what they call it, is like a train
whistle.
Yeah, like a train whistle. His head becomes a train whistle when he kind of judders around and causes like the walls to shake. And there was a drinks company that really wanted it to be their drink, even though as the writers kind of pointed out, like it doesn't look like it has a very nice effect. Like it would seem like quite an odd thing to want to drink. But yeah.
The monster reminded me of the Toffee Monster from the Toffee Monster book that we talked about a little while ago.
Well, maybe there needs to be a children's horror kind of novelisation of this film. I could write that. Like, I think if you removed some of the aspects, you know, it would be a great little children's horror novel.
I don't think it would be hard for this film to have been a really good piece of children's horror. It's only that desire to transgress and be incredibly horny and portray swinging in quite so much detail.
It is quite committed to that.
Also pretty homophobic, but like specifically against Greek
people. Yeah, that bit's really odd, isn't it? Because it feels like otherwise it's going to be a really non-judgmental kind of open-minded film, and then suddenly it has this really odd thing about the Greek guy really fancying the husband, and it suddenly becomes reactionary. It's really strange.
I mean, I don't know whether we're supposed to like praise the husband in that situation anyway. Like, I don't know if the message there was that he was being unaccepting unnecessarily. Like, it's more just like sex farce kind of stuff, but not in any way committed to. I don't know what it's a strange film. It's a strange film. I don't know why you made me watch it. I still
don't know, but I did. I think, to be fair, listeners to the podcast at this point, if people are like listen to the Roger Rabbit bit, then you know, stop the episode. I get it. Like, it might be whoever made the children's horror list accidentally added Terrorvision to their list.
Yeah,
it is 15 rated, like, as well. By the way, like,
yeah, that's interesting.
Just so our listeners are clear.
Okay. I mean,
and I guess that they are targeting specifically 15-year-olds as like the only possible demographic.
No, I think 15-year-olds are too. I think 15-year-olds are too old to enjoy this.
A particularly immature 15-year-old.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So basically, Beavis and Butthead are the target. demographic for this film.
Yeah. Right.
So yeah, you know, if you're listening to this, you're like, my tastes are exactly that of Beavis and Buttheads. There is a guy who loves metal, like a kind of Beavis. He is a bit like a sort of Butthead type character, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who is also able to like whisper and calm the alien down by the resemblance of his studded metal gloves to the gloves of the caretaker of the sanitation facility.
Yeah.
Makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah, we get a nice sort of subjective alien flashback to the alien being petted by the sanitation.
Yeah,
I did enjoy that actually. Yeah.
And then that leads to like a brief chunk of the film where again it's being like now the parents have been off. Like the structure of this film is a bit off. It's what I'm trying to say.
This 10 minutes of them just like. Trying to teach the alien to talk and understand.
Yeah, like it suddenly becomes that sort of film where it's like, oh, like, I mean, it references E.T., right? And actually it's doing that thing of like, oh, this alien, like, let's teach him to talk and show them telly and music and food, the three most important things in human culture, according to Susie. In a way that, like, genuinely delights me. Like, I'm not even saying that it's wrong. but then it feels like it's going to become a satire. Like, I don't know. It's weird. It's weird. Because it's doing all of that after it spent quite a long time in the sex farce mode.
Yeah. I mean, okay. So if I had the inclination, which I don't, I guess I probably could make a kind of 45-minute edit of this film, which does work as a children's horror film.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. I think there's a couple of the innuendos that are just about acceptable.
Yeah.
So that you wouldn't just have to be cutting out all of the dialogue.
Yeah, yeah.
And it would probably need to be reordered a little bit, and it would probably still be quite weird.
Yeah, I don't think it's worth it. I don't think there's a masterpiece to be salvaged here, if I'm honest.
No. I did enjoy it. The theme music is incredible.
Oh, by the Fibonacci.
The Fibonacci has provided like a television theme song that is like a really lustrous piece of Italo pop.
Can you give us some of the theme tune in the edit?
Yes. Here's the theme tune.
Thank you.
I'm trying to remember it to start singing it at that point.
The granddad has a good idea about eating lizard tails, which...
Oh, yeah, he's an entrepreneur. He's going to Dragon's Den.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought that was quite good. apart from
it's a shame that Medusa, like, it does feel like they fully like Deus Ex Machina to like solve everything, and then Medusa Ex Machina to destroy and immediately murder the solution that had arrived to the whole situation.
It is quite funny, like, that they have the spaceman, the sanitation worker arrive, and he's gonna just sort it all out, and then Medusa appears and smashes him over the head, and his head explodes, and then she's like, yeah, I'm a hero! And then they all die.
Yeah, it's a pleasing moment.
Yeah.
Well, look, at least you've got some good. We've got some good Halloween costumes from this film for next Halloween. Like, I want to be Grandpa in his battery jacket.
I'm going to be Susie.
Oh, okay.
Oh no, I should be Medusa.
Oh, okay. Or maybe I'll be Susie.
You could be Susie.
I thought that you would have liked Susie.
Yeah. The Cyndi Lauper of it all.
Yeah. It's very Cyndi Lauper. Okay, so that was Terrorvision.
If anyone feels obliged to watch it as a result of our discussions, I would like to apologise in advance.
Yeah, we're not suggesting that, to be clear.
Yeah, like, while I think we are all struggling to try and dig up as many redeeming features as we can, I don't think it's a masterpiece.
Yeah.
Okay, that's fair.
Right. Thank you for joining for us for this discussion, Ava. It's been lovely to have you back.
It's been a pleasure. It's really nice. I'm slightly distressed at what you made me watch, I loved one of them. I loved one of them a lot.
Yeah.
we'll maybe have you back for some more Bob Hoskins action in the future.
I definitely want to talk about Super Mario Brothers more. I'm keen on that. I don't think it's really horror, but it does have a lot of those kind of like horrific visual elements to it.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, my criteria when I choose stuff is just, did this or would this have horrified me as a child? And that does give us a very broad reason.
Yeah.
The Mario Brothers film definitely did.
Yeah.
Alright, so our intro music's by Maki Yamazaki, our outro music's by Joe Kelly, our artwork's by Letty Wilson. You can find the details in the show notes, where there's also a transcript. You can email us at stillscaredpodcast@gmail.com or follow us on Instagram at stillscaredpodcast.
What's that one where people say really like sassy comments?
Oh, Letterboxd.
Yeah, on Letterboxd as well at stillscared.
Excellent.
How sassy is Still Scared on Letterboxd?
I don't know, fairly sassy. I basically use my movie reviews, but only for children's horror.
So. Okay, I see.
Do you have a sign off for us, Adam?
Just watched Who Framed Roger Rabbit, not Terrorvision recently.
A factual one, right.
Very classic down the line.
See you next time, spooky kids. Bye.
Bye.